Good morning. I'm Doug Rademacher. I'm with the Fisher Body Historical Team, and we're here to interview Randy Taylor, and it is October the 6th, approximately 10:20 in the morning. Good morning, Randy. Would you please state your name and your address for the record?
Randy Taylor. I live in Flushing, Michigan. I'm right here at Fisher Body.
And are you married?
Yes, I am.
Do you have any children?
Two kids. Both grown. One grandkid, one more on the way.
Congratulations. Would you please tell me a little bit about your education?
Went to Flushing High School, Flushing Schools. Took a couple years up to Central Michigan University, and then... After that, I went through the apprenticeship program through AC Spark Plug in Flint.
Local 651.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And do you have any military service?
No, I don't. Okay.
Well, we want to talk to you today about your history here at Fisher Body. Can you tell me, how many years do you have here?
I came down to Fisher Body January of 2000 as a transfer from AC Spark Plug, which went to Delphi, which then they came out with the flowback agreement. And I was the first one to raise my hand and say, how can I get out of Delphi?
Looking at today's state of the business, I'm sure you're glad that was the right move for you.
Smartest thing I think I've ever done.
And which department did you hire into?
Paint department.
And what was your... Did you come right into trades?
Yeah.
So you hired into the paint department as a...
As a millwright.
As a millwright. Mm-hmm. Can you describe the duties of a millwright for people that don't really know what a millwright is?
Basically, jack of all trades, whatever the pipe fitters and electricians and the tinsmiths don't want to do, the millwrights end up doing. All the heavy stuff, moving anything, construction of any heavy steel, building steel, anything like that. Conveyor maintenance, conveyor breakdown. At least, like I say, this is mostly paint shop experience that I'm talking about. Like I say, just basically, you know, everything that's broke and nobody wants to lay claim to it, we end up doing it.
Randy, while we're there, when you came in on your first day, what was your first day like in this plant as a millwright How did they receive you when you came?
Oh, the reception was great. I was just in awe because you have to understand, coming from AC Spark Plug, we made spark plugs, fuel filters, air filters, small little things that just went 90 miles an hour down the assembly line. We assembled over a million spark plugs a week, and I'm dealing with conveyors that are, you know, 3.5 inches wide and going a bazillion miles an hour, and we come down here and you got this piece of chain that's this long and it's all you can do to pick it up. When they say, hey, you got to replace that, and you know the wrench is about the A long rather than my little 9/16 and half inch wrench I carry around in my pocket that can pretty much fix anything. But people down here were great, you know, even coming from a different plant, you know, and a different local and everything. And I'd say, hey, you know, who are you? Introduce, you know, they'd introduce themselves and whatnot, and they said, hey, we're glad to have you down here, you know.
Now, you just shared a few sizes by some hand gestures, but the people that are listening to this won't have any idea. How big was yay long piece of chain, and how big was that?
Oh, well, like I say, you know, you're talking, you know, the conveyor chain here in this plant, you know, each link itself is 6 inches long. And then you get a length of 10-foot chain, and you got to have two guys to pick it up and carry it around because you can't do it by yourself. And sometimes on the breakdowns when you need a lot of leverage to, you know, cars get jammed up or you have, you know, cars that piggyback, they ride up on top of one another. And you need to get a 6-foot pry bar out, or you might have to have a 5-foot long wrench to get enough leverage to be able to move the chain so you can release the tension and get everybody going and make them all happy again.
So kind of found that quite exciting to quite a change from
it was
a small assembly part to the
quite a difference, yeah.
The automobile.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Yeah.
Jerry, you have a question?
Yes. Were you a millwright when you were at Delphi?
Yes, I was.
So you just switched from there to here as a millwright.
Right, yep. Yeah, I was hired on as a apprenticeship millwright at AC Sparkplug. And went through my apprenticeship program there and everything. And then, like I say, in May of 99, they announced that all of AC, well, at that time it was AC Delco, would be now Delphi. And then our great union got our flowback agreement and scooted on out of there.
Congratulations. Which shift did you hire into Fisher Body?
The second shift.
Now, was that, for you, was that a preferred shift, or was that just, didn't matter at the time?
It didn't matter really too much at the time. I'm not real comfortable with getting up with alarm clocks at 4 o'clock in the morning. Of course, you have to understand my situation. I got a 52-mile commute one way back and forth. So first shift starting at 6 o'clock, I got to be on the road by 4:45, which is an ungodly hour of the morning. So second shift definitely worked out better for me.
Next question would be, did you have any other members of your family work here or in the auto industry before you went to AC?
Yeah, my my brother is a millwright at he was a millwright at Buick City, which is in Flint, and he, when that shut down, he transferred up to the Saginaw Metal Casting, which casts the aluminum heads and blocks for the motors. My brother-in-law is a millwright. He started at Chevy V8, which in that close, he went to the Chevy six-cylinder line. As a matter of fact, right now he's in Japan looking at new equipment for their new engine plant that they're building in Flint.
659s. Metal, what's that, Flint Engine South, that group?
Yep. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we got my brother, my brother-in-law, and my sister-in-law is an electrician at Buick City. She's still there at Buick City. So
you're the only escapee, is that?
Yeah. The only one over the fence.
So tell about the change. I'm sure you've got the stories from all of them. Do you have a good story to tell them about coming to Lansing, or is it?
Got a funny story.
All right.
When the C line was going down, which was Christmas, I think it was 2 years ago. Anyways, the last night that we were here, I brought my son-in-law in to see the factory. He'd never been inside a General Motors factory, car assembly factory, or anything, you know. So I brought him in with me, and we had a rent-a-boss, I guess you'd call it. And I put him in a set of coveralls and gave him a hat and a pair of glasses, and the boss never asked once who he was. And he had a big breakdown, and he went out on a breakdown with us, and carrying chains up the stairs, going up in 21-3, and nobody ever said boo to him.
And while we're on that subject,
Mike.
While we're on that subject about rent-a-bosses, we all in this room understand what a rent-a-boss is. Could you explain?
The contract employees, contract supervisors. We had a real good boss. At that time, I was on third shift, still in paint, and we had a real good boss, Brad Shively, that took a position over to Car Assembly, which was across town. And so they brought a temporary contractual boss in.
Thank you.
Tell me, what's the working conditions like inside Fisher Body for you?
Well, do you want to... If you want to go to paint, you're going to find some nasty creatures you don't want to have in your bedroom or in your house. It's an old plant, and in some of the areas, it's very dark and very wet, and so you get some critters that... everybody's not too fond of. You move a piece of equipment and you'll find all sorts of them scattering. And being that it's an old plant, a lot of different levels, paint ovens and that go uphill and downhill and everything. And, you know, being on the maintenance crew and everything, you have to do a PM inspection every 2 months. So you're walking through the ovens, and if you're claustrophobic, you don't want to be in there because it's just wide enough and just high enough for a car body to fit through, and that's it. And, you know, so you're going through a half-mile oven with no lights. You know, you just got your trusty little flashlight with you and everything. Then, stark contrast, you go into the clean room of the paint department where, you know, it's just spotless, and it has to be. So it varies, you know, depending on where you're at.
So why would you do it?
Wait a minute. Could you, for those once again who don't know, can you say what PM is, please?
Oh, preventative maintenance.
Thank you.
I was just curious, why would you do that preventative, that walkthrough in the dark? I understand the plant's not running, but what are you looking for to walk through in an evening walkthrough?
Well, we're on third shift, and so we'd come in, you know, the ovens would be shut down in the evening and whatnot, and after they cool down enough to where we could get into them, we would have to walk the conveyors, which was basically just a track that the car bodies were situated on a dolly. The conveyor chain would pull these dollies down this track, and there'd be wear items, the steel in the track that would wear out, that would break. There's, in the ovens, it's arranged in kind of a continuous S-curve, so a lot of curves and whatnot, and a lot of places for the chain to wear out. The conveyor chain's constructed in a way to where there's wear strips that are meant to wear out so that the chain doesn't wear out. So it's kind of a throwaway item type, you know. So that's what you're looking for.
Yeah. Interesting. How has your supervisory techniques changed over the years? Did you have the way supervisors conducted business, is it the same as it when you hired in, or has things changed in how they set up work or something?
I guess I've been fortunate in that I've always had really good bosses that were really close with the maintenance personnel, and maybe it's just something that's indigenous to being in maintenance versus being on the line, because our, you know, we don't have a pace that has to be maintained, you know, and ours is kind of more like a reactive type situation. And so all the bosses that I've had have been really good as far as, you know, as far as communicating things, as far as, you know, if I need any tools or any equipment or anything like that, they've all been really good about getting it. And, you know, and usually it's always been the older bosses, or I should say fellas that have been around a lot, because, you know, you get the new hires or new bosses basically are on the production, this is just what I've seen, you know, around the production floor, and then after 15, 20 years or so, if they got the seniority, you know, it's not like a union, but if, you know, they put in their time, then hopefully they can get a little bit choicer position, and it seems like they'd all kind of graduate up into a maintenance type situation to where it's a little bit more laid back than having to be on the line all the time.
Have you noticed any environmental changes in the conditions of the plant?
Yeah, it's gotten better as far as you know, just the cleanliness of it, you know, as far as the paint and whatnot, you know, and talking to some of the guys that have been around for years and years and years, you know, they just tell horror stories about what it used to be like, you know, with the fumes and the smells and everything. And it's definitely a lot better than what it was from talking to these guys. Like I say, with the short time that I was here, I didn't notice too much of a difference, really.
Did you ever have a layoff?
Yeah, for 2 weeks. I wish it was longer.
Tell about that. What caused the layoff? What were you out for?
It was last year when we were shutting down the plants for 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off type of thing because of the cutback and the orders and everything. So maintenance at the time, they were trying to save some money too, knowing that the plant was going to be decommissioned shortly. There was one period where the plant was down for 2 weeks, and we actually got to have those 2 weeks off, where normally we're just working all the time when the plant's closed.
Over the period of years, they had what they called changeovers, where they would introduce the new models. Did you ever have any of those changeover downtimes?
Yeah. It's when we're down, when everybody's gone and it's changeover, it's a lot of work. And you're going 90 miles an hour pretty much all the time just to get everything done, because you know they got a set date, they want to have this stuff done, and so a lot of construction and a lot of moving things around, getting set up for different lines. And just like when the plant here was closing and we switched everything from the M line, which was upstairs, and they wanted everything downstairs, and we had a target date to hit. This was when everybody was coming back to work, and everything had to be moved, everything had to be changed and re-anchored down, and it was pretty interesting.
While you're on the subject of moving and moving things around, you mentioned earlier that millwrights do everything that doesn't get done, especially the heavy work. We're in a period or at a juncture now when the plant is being disassembled. Talk to us about what you all are doing as millwrights to help disassemble the plant and what type of job it would take to get that done.
Well, a lot of things, a lot of equipment that was in our plant when we first shut down, and I'm not completely clear of the process, but I understand other plants would put in a requisition for whatever parts or equipment that we had that they would be interested in. We had quite a bit of aluminum, what they call night rail, that holds overhead tooling, air tools, and whatnot for the production lines that ended up going to Mexico and to Canada. There was probably over 15,000 feet of that was taken out of the ceiling and sent out. Robots that other plants had an interest in, robots that we could use at the new plant for training, were disconnected by the pipe fitters and electricians, and then millwrights would go in and physically pick the robot up and get it to a dock and put it on the truck so the trucks could take it to the new location. Just a lot of the small equipment that you just take for granted, things that were just here all the time, you know, just small welders, grinders, things that you just normally use every day that you don't think about until, oops, you know, we're at the new plant and all of a sudden we don't have that thing, have that stuff, you know, that, you know, we just got to go through the whole plant and get it out of there, load it up, either skid it or, you know, put it on a wooden skid or put it in a big wire basket and band it up and get it on a truck and get it over to the new plant. Like I say, a lot of small equipment that takes a lot of time that you need as far as on a maintenance perspective that you basically need it every day.
Sure.
You know, and you know GM's not going to buy new stuff when we have perfectly working, good working equipment here at this plant.
Doreen, do you have your own personal equipment too that you have to purchase yourself for you?
Yeah.
Your own toolbox?
Right, yeah. Well, GM provides the toolbox for us. And like I say, a lot of the specialized tools that we need to do our job, they'll purchase. Normal hand tools and everything, we get the union negotiated a tool allowance for skilled trades, so that we're able to purchase our own hand tools and whatnot with that allowance. And so all that is being shipped over. Everybody, all the trades got new toolboxes because of the new 5-foot rule, I guess it is, over the new plant. And so they constructed new toolboxes and everything for everybody.
Explain the 5-foot rule.
5-foot rule basically is just a line of sight at the new plant. The managers felt they wanted everything, if possible, below 5 foot, so you have a nice clean view of the plant floor that you'll be able to look across, be able to observe everything that's going on. And it will help make things, and it opens the plant up quite a bit, you know, to where you're able to see. So if there's necessarily a problem, you know, that hopefully it'll come to light a little bit sooner.
Did you ever have a problem with manpower in the trades here at Fisher Body? Was there enough manpower? Was there enough trades? I know that you know, the apprenticeships and stuff were put on hold for a while. So can you share a little of that? Is there, you guys always work together? Has there been a time when there wasn't enough manpower to get the job done properly or safely?
Yeah, we've, especially as millwrights, being that most of our jobs are fairly heavy, complex, or involved, you just don't want to, especially down here, you don't want to do them by yourself. You really do need to, and we are always taxed for, we've had so many people retire, and like you say, the apprenticeship programs have been put on hold. We haven't had any new apprenticeships. And so if you just look at the numbers, just in the short time that I've been here to Fisher Body, and the same thing is true over when I was at AC Spark Plug, the trades numbers have really dwindled. And now especially be interesting at the new plant, because we're going to have 18 millwrights for the body shop, which is where I'll be at in new place. So that'll be 6 per shift, whereas before you had at least 10 on each shift. And you have a body shop that's actually going to be bigger than what we have here now, and almost twice as many robots.
Could you share one of your days? What time did you start, and what did you do for your lunch hour?
Third shift, when I was up in paint, working third shift, we would start at 10 o'clock in the evening, and we would come in, and basically being a two-shift operation, the boss would meet us. We would have a picnic table that we all sat to have a cup of coffee and whatnot. When we first came in, the boss would come around and give us basically a lineup of jobs that he wanted to be done after production went home, anywhere between 2:30, 3:30 in the morning. And like I say, we had... We had 8 guys in paint, and we were divvied up into 2 fellas that would handle breakdowns, and myself and my partner, we would handle the PMs of preventative maintenance. And then after the line went down, depending on the type of job and whatnot that the boss would have for us. And there again, they were really flexible. A lot of times we would... work through our lunch hours just so we could have a little bit longer break at the end of the day to kind of kick back and relax a little bit. Being on third shift, you're kind of afforded that opportunity.
You said you started in on the second shift, and you didn't like to wake up anyway, so that was good. But how did that affect your family life, making that drive and not being in Flint, where you're from, with the kids and your wife? Can you share a little bit about what it's like to...
Well, fortunately, in my situation, when I went on second shift, it was in 2000, both my kids are grown. My daughter got married the year after that, and she was out of the house already. My son, he was in college, and so basically it was just myself and my wife at home at the time. And she is a freelance interpreter for the deaf, so she can pretty much schedule her own hours. So when I was on second shift, she most of the time just try and get her schedule to be a little bit more in line with mine so that she would be home in the morning when I was home. And then she would work in the afternoons. I would have to leave the house at 12:30 to be down here at 2 to start at second shift in the afternoon. And then she'd go to work and she'd be home by the time I got home. So it, actually for me it worked. It was kind of like the best of both worlds. I didn't have to get up in the morning and still had family life.
We're going to pause for a moment. We're back with Randy Taylor. Randy, would you please tell me, what is your view of your coworker? Do you see them as brothers and sisters?
Yeah. Especially being in trades, you're always partnered up with somebody. And so you see a lot of these guys that have been partnered up for years, and I mean, they're just, they're like, you know, best buds that have been together ever since, you know, they were growing up, you know. And I've always had a real good relationship with whoever I'm working with to get along with them and everything. And you just naturally, you know, you're on the job and you're working and you're just going to talk about things that, you know, pertain to your life and whatnot and share things, you know. Grandkids and daughters getting married and boys getting out of school and graduating, things like that, you know. So you just naturally develop those ties and those bonds between the people and everything. So it's you end up developing a relationship that starts at work and it just flows to where it just ends up being outside of work also, you know.
Has a particular coworker impacted your family life?
Yeah, there's been a number of them through the years, you know, that you just, like I say, you develop those friendships and whatnot, you know, and some fade and go away and then new ones start up. And it just getting to know different people from different walks of life and everything. And everybody's different viewpoint and their different takes on life. It just gives you a richer just the understanding of what everybody else has to go through. You're not in it, you know, you're just not in it alone.
Well, I'd like to have an explanation of your interaction with the worker on the line. Is that as a trades perspective and as a personal perspective?
Yeah.
Can you share something on that?
Yeah, third shift you didn't have a lot of reaction when I was on second shift, and also when I was working at AC Spark Plug on second shift here in Paint, you'd get to know everybody on the line because, you know, they would have a breakdown or they would have a problem, and through their boss they'd get a hold of you and you'd come down, you'd talk to them and find out, you know, what the problem is and whatnot, you know, and you'd get to know everybody on the line, get to know names and whatnot. And so they'd always, whenever there was always special dinners and whatnot for somebody's birthday and everything, and we were always invited, you know, to come by and grab some cake or whatnot, you know, to join in with them and everything. It wasn't an adversarial type relationship because we're all, you know, like you say, we're all working for the same company. We're all in the same union. We're all brothers, you know. And the same thing there at AC Spark Plug, too. You know, Christmas dinners and Thanksgiving dinners and whatnot, we'd all get together and have a heck of a good time.
Well, you keep referring back to the two different scenarios, from Flint, AC, all the way back to Fisherbody, Lansing. Can you tell me, what vehicle do you drive for all those miles?
Well, when I first... when I first started driving down here, I had my real nice car, and I was putting on 35,000 miles a year on it, and I told the wife, I says, this isn't going to work. I just ended up buying a $1,000 beater from my nephew and just drove the snot out of it till the wheels fell off, and went out and just bought another one for a couple $1,000s, and it's got like 92,000 miles. I'll drive that one till the motor falls out of it. And
did you ever consider buying a foreign vehicle?
Oh, no. My son-in-law, when he was dating my daughter, he drove up in his daddy's car one time, and it was a Audi, and I told him he had to park out on the street. He didn't believe me until I actually made him park out on the street.
So, is there anything that you did within the plant? There was lots of different groups. You said you were included in the dinners and things. Did you have any special interests that you participated in? I know I see people play harmonica, or they may have a Bible study group. But was there anything that you did as a culture within the plant?
No, not really. And I think a lot of that, like I say, probably could be attributed to the fact that with the overtime, working the overtime, driving, you know, 2.5 hours out of each day kind of takes a big bite out of your schedule, you know. And so you want to spend as much time as you can to family and everything. So as far as involvements in that area, I never really got involved in that type of thing.
A lot of times in places like this, you hear about people that do pranks. You got any pranks that were pulled on you or that you pulled on someone else?
I've heard quite a few stories, but I was never a participant or participee or other than just normal, you know, normal goofing around every day type of thing, you know. But there was a couple of guys that, one fella, he was getting married, and so we took his toolbox and we painted it white and we put pink little hearts all over the toolbox just before he got married.
Did you paint those on, or were they hard for him to get off, or was it something?
They were all stickers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so he just had to peel stickers off and get his box repainted, so it wasn't anything permanent or anything like that, you know.
What's your best memory of working at this Fisher Body plant?
I would just have to say probably the best memory is just the working relationships and everything, just the people, really. You know, the people make it enjoyable to work here. You know, even if you got the best job in the world and you got a complete jackass that you got to sit across from or that you got to relate to for 8 hours out of the day, it's going to be a terrible experience.
Do you recall your best job and or your worst job that you had to do here?
Worst job would have been doing, again, we're back to PMs. Preventative maintenance what they call bond rate, and you're crawling through a terrible, nasty place, and a lot of chemicals. And
I think we need to stop for a second.
Randy, would you share your best and/or your worst job memory?
Worst job would have to be doing inspections, again, back into the paint department. They have a collection system that funnels water underneath the paint booths that collects paint and whatnot, and goes down into a filter, and basically the sludge gets filtered out. So the water can be recycled, and it's just a nasty smelling purple crap, because when you take every color in the world imaginable and you mix it together, you don't get black. You get a funky-looking purple junk. And it's just sticky and nasty, and you get out of there and it's hot, and you're just... it's just terrible with all the chemical smells and everything. And the best job... best job I had, and you're not going to believe this, we had a huge, huge crash. the cars would get painted, and then they would be inspected and bought off, meaning that they'd be okay as far as the paint has no defects and the quality is good, and then they would be shipped from 21-3, which is building 21 third floor, and they would be shipped on a conveyor chain, down, I'd have to say this conveyor chain's probably at least a good half mile long from a third floor building basically down to a second floor building to be ready to be put into the trim department. And for whatever reason, we had a big crash. Cars ended up piled one on top of one another, upside down, falling off a conveyor trestle that was 35 feet up in the air. And we had to call in. We had a crane, a mobile crane, that we brought upstairs. And we had to pick each individual car off. And if it, you know, basically the cars were junk that got involved in the accident. So I was climbing all over brand new cars, jumping on their roofs, you know, trying to dislodge them and tying chains around them so the crane can pick them up and set them out. And it's kind of interesting. Whenever you have a big breakdown like that, a big crisis, because obviously something like that just shuts the entire plant down because paint can't run, and pretty soon trim's out of cars, so trim can't build any cars. Body can't ship any cars out of the body shop because the paint shop's not running. And so you have every white shirt, which is to say every boss in the entire plant, coming up to figure out what's going on. And you're out there trying to do your job. And Amy Farmer was there. And finally, I just got fed up. And they were way too close. It wasn't safe for them to be there. And I looked at my boss and I says, "Can I say something?" He said, "Go right ahead." And so I yelled at all these supervisors, all these white shirts. I just told them, "Get the hell out of my way. Let me do my job."
That was your best moment.
Yep, that was my best moment.
How long did it take to pull all these cars out of there?
Believe it or not, we had the plant up and running in less than 2 hours.
And what was the problem?
One body had come down the hill, and they're on a dolly. The body is basically bare. There's no interior, no motors, just a steel body, and they're on a four-wheel dolly. And one of the wheels broke on the dolly, which caused it to tip up, which then the next car coming down got underneath it, picked it up, and then it was just a chain reaction from there.
In-plant dominoes.
Yep.
So, have you ever done anything for somebody, like build a locker or repair something or build something to make your job easier or someone on the line?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's all the time. When you're dealing, you know, with production and whatnot, you know, you have guys that'll come up and they'll want you to modify a cart or, you know, something to make their job easier and everything. And it, you know, everybody's, you know, "Hey, can you do me a favor? Can you do this for me?" "Sure, no problem. You know, if you got time, do this." And yeah, we're always doing things, fixing things, you know, and making little things.
As far as a union man, did you attend union meetings?
No, not here in Lansing, I didn't. And the reason for that is because, number one, the drive, and I attended when I was in Flint at the union meeting up there because they always have the union meetings on Sunday, and either I'm working, which means I have to drive in early and then wait for work to start, or, you know, it just didn't work out for me.
I want to go back to your job. Can you tell me, would you like to tell people a little bit about the importance of skilled trades personnel and their tools?
Well, as far as tools, like I say, you know, we purchase a majority of our tools ourselves. General Motors, you know, like I say, would specialty things that we need, you know, to do our job, they would purchase, because a lot of this stuff you can't get by going to Sears, you know, and Craftsman don't make something like this, you know, and Snap-on doesn't make something like this. It's an industrial tool supplier that you have to get these items from. But, yeah, there's skilled trades, I think, and as far as millwrights are more along the line of, say, like a mechanic, and I got, you know, your favorite sticker where, you know, you don't touch these tools in my toolbox, it's my livelihood, you know, mm-hmm. type of thing. And so, yeah, you don't mess with another guy's tools, and you always, working together and everything, I've always been, and other guys too, have always been real considerate about, you know, if they want to borrow a tool from you, they'll say, hey, you know, can I borrow this from you? And you'll say, yeah, it's in my drawer, you know, third drawer down or whatever. You know, they just don't go in and start rummaging through your toolbox. You know, that's your private area, your space. You know, you don't get a lot of that in a factory.
Has there ever been, like, an initiation for a rookie to learn or apprentice to learn the importance of tools, or to respect their own tools?
Yeah, there's, I don't know, like I say, I've never participated in it. I've heard of it being done where, you know, in order to teach somebody a lesson, you know, they'll take and pump their toolbox full of grease. So that kind of gets your attention, you know, if something like that were to happen.
You got to know about the tools. But I know you have to work as a team. Would you want to tell us a little bit about, I know you have to have lockouts and safeties because you guys do things like, you know, take on dominoes apart and things
right,
like that
yeah.
with cars, and as far as it being safety, could you tell people a little bit about the safety and lockouts and things like that?
Yeah, it's, you know, and it's not just something that we do just because, you know, GM says, hey, you got to do this and this and this, you know. It's something that you do because it's your own personal safety. You know, when all the way from a big crash, you know, to where you want to make sure you got all the conveyors locked out, that it's not going to start running automatically because these things take off and go on their own, you know. You want to make sure that's locked out, that there's no power to it. You want to make sure that electricity's shut off, because a lot of times if you do have a big crash like that, it ends up cutting through electrical lines too for sensors and things like that. All the way down to just working on a sprayer, a paint sprayer robot. You know, same thing. That robot doesn't know you're there. It doesn't have eyes, and it's a heck of a lot bigger than you are. And, you know, there again, these things, they all run off sensors. They all run automatically. They can't tell you from a car. If you were to trip a sensor, that robot's going to start spraying paint. And if you don't want to be green or two-tone blue with missing two fingers, you make sure you turn it off, you know. It's just a smart thing to do, and like I say, it becomes. I find myself even to be more conscious of it at home, just because of the fact that you're just posters everywhere. It's ingrained to you at work. You know, take two for safety. Lock it out. You know, be safe. You know, just take the time to make sure you're going to be okay. And so then you get that kind of a mindset, and you go back home. I'm helping my son-in-law wire up his new house and everything. And it's like, are you sure this is off? Well, go check, make sure it's off before I stick my fingers in here. That type of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm. On kind of on the same line, Have you ever seen anybody that may have not followed any safety rules or had mishaps for whatever reason why you were here?
I've never had a mishap like that, you know, to where it would be kind of like a life-threatening type situation, you know. I've gotten, you know, bangs and bruises, things like that, just because of the nature of, you know, being a millwright, you're on a pry bar and everything, and something will break loose and it just lets go, and you just got to make sure you get out of the way. Sometimes you don't get out of the way fast enough. You know, other than, you know, I got all my fingers and my toes and whatnot, you know, I know of fellas that have lost fingers here at the plant and working at home, you know, just being careless, just being, you know, hey, this is the last thing we got to do today, let's hurry up, let's get it done, and then we can go take a break, and boom, it's too late.
So has there been many changes since you've been here as far as maybe more safety precautions put into effect, or are they about the same?
Well, I would, yeah, there's more, and I think it's I guess used to be, you know, 10 years ago, lockout was just kind of laissez-faire type of thing. You know, the bosses weren't really, you know, they just wanted the job done. If there was a problem, they, you know, go take care of it. I don't care how you do it. Just get it fixed and get us running and everything. And now it's progressed to a point where, you know, they themselves are concerned a little bit more about doing it a safe way. And I think it's a good thing, you know.
Did you have a problem ever working with women in trades, or different ethnicities? Or did that ever play into your workplace?
No, I don't have. You know, I never had a problem with her or anything like that. You know, as far as, you know, working with different people, you know, that doesn't bother me at all. And I had a journeyman when I was in apprenticeship training, Eddie Moore, and he was a black fellow, and he was just funnier than snot. But he just he had all his money. He's a tradesman. He's got all his money, and he lives in this little shack in the worst part of North End of Flint, you know. And he'd come into work with all these horror stories, you know, and I'd kid him all the time, you know, to get out of there and everything, but he just wouldn't leave, you know. But the only if there is a problem, I guess the only thing I would say that would be, the only thing I've seen is with women in trades is on the millwright side, a lot of times, you know, you need the muscle to get the job done, and some, you know, and women just being women, you know, they're not as strong as the guys are, you know. So, and you, so what happens is you just, I don't know if it's a, I'm trying to think of the word I want to use, I can't, it's gone, but like a discriminatory type of thing, but you end up seeing the women taking the easier, lighter jobs, and then the guys do all their heavier type of work, you know. And, but, you know, that's okay.
Well, I always, myself always said that we had our grandmother and our grandfather, I'm sure you had one also, and grandpa didn't expect the same amount of labor out of grandma, but
right.
He expected the same amount of effort. I was just curious then. You said that you didn't attend union meetings here. Do you take the time to go vote? And what do you think of your union leadership compared to this plan? Or you've seen two different unions. How does this union fare in your work experience?
Yeah, I've, you know, I participated in all the whatever votes we have, you know, for contracts and for committee men and things like that, whatever comes up. The unions, as far as 651, which was in Flint, and 602, a lot of the same things. I would say Flint was probably a little bit more, I don't want to say not aggressive, but conflict, you know. They were more at a conflict with their, with General Motors type of thing. It seems like here in Lansing with Union, with the local 602, there's more of a better working relationship between the union and the management. Not that, you know, you see eye to eye all the time, but they're just, like you say, I think everybody in Flint was a rebel. We had to go out on strike to prove it, you know. So.
Speaking of that, have you been out on strike?
Yeah.
How many times?
Twice. Both times in Flint.
For very long?
One was in 98, was for 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And in 93 was it? Or no, 95 was 3 days.
What is your most appreciated bargain benefit?
The money. Healthcare. You know, paid vacations. It's hard to say which one you enjoy more, really, you know. I mean, the union negotiated the wage package that pays you enough money that you can have a good quality life and enjoy the things of life, you know, that whether it be, you know, motorcycling, snowmobiling, camping, you know, I do it all, you know. There's very few jobs out there that have that kind of level of pay. The benefits, you know, the health benefits and whatnot that we enjoy, that you can just, you know that it's, you know, no matter what happens, it's going to be taken care of, you know. Being able to take time off and have paid vacations, you know, and spending time with your family. You know, it's hard to say which one, you know, they all kind of all mix together to just give you a better quality of life so you can enjoy it.
Has your skills that you've gained through the skilled trades arena carried outside of the plant? And do you said you're helping your son-in-law do some work with the housing, electrical. Do you have a business on the side, or do you do things for your community back in Flint that pertain to your trade?
Well, I'd say as far, you know, it's nice to have a reservoir of people that have so many, that are knowledgeable about so many things. I'm not an electrician by trade, but, you know, for example, working on my son-in-law's house and everything, you know, I have a question about an electrical problem. I come in here to work, I talk to the guys and say, hey, you know, this is what we got. How can I do this? You know, what do I have to do to fix this, or what's the proper way to do this, you know? Skills that I've learned on a job as far as myself, I use a lot because I'm into restoring older vehicles and everything. And so I'm turning a lot of wrenches. I'm doing a lot of welding and things like that. So that helps me.
I have one last question to ask you before we wrap this up here. How do you feel about the plant closing and the prospects of the new plant? You know, you've already made a transition once. Do you have any, you know, words of wisdom for people like myself who've never had to go through any type of transition from one facility to another? Or
Well, it's sad to see this place close down, you know, because there a lot of years and everything, but you look at it and it's just, like I say, unless you're actually, for instance, up in Paint and you're walking the miles of conveyor and you're going from one floor to the next, and you think, boy, this is really stupid. How can they ever build a car on three different levels of a plant, you know, and make money doing it type of thing? You know, if you look at it that way, it's easy to say, yeah, you know, it makes more sense to build a new building. But then, you know, a lot of history here and whatnot, you know. But it's all in your comfort level, you know. You tend to get comfortable working in one place, and you hate to see that change. You know, I loved working at AC Spark Plug. I didn't want to leave there. But for my financial well-being, for my family and whatnot, you know, I felt it was a better decision to come down here. And so I came down here, and, you know, then, you know, we find out we're closing while they're building this new factory. That's pretty exciting in itself. There's not many people in General Motors that can say, you know, hey, I was here at ground one, you know, when the new building went up. And so it's an exciting time because you do have that opportunity that not a lot of people within the corporation would have that. But then, again, like I say, you know, it's just, we're comfortable back here in the old place. You know, we all, you know, this is where we work. You know, we know where everything's at. We feel good here, you know, and you hate to leave that. But
leaving an old friend behind.
Yep, exactly.
I guess the last question then, she led into the new plant. You and I had some training together. What do you think about the way they're preparing us to go into this brand new facility, this great opportunity? What did you think of that?
I think it's good. I've been through a lot of training, not only with Doug, with the GMS, but I've been down in Detroit quite a few times with conveyor, you know, new conveyor training, robots, new robot training and everything with the new robots we're going to have in the plant. And I've learned a lot just through those type of classes on the different equipment that we're going to have and everything. And like I say, I personally, myself, I think it's a pretty exciting time. You know, you're going in brand new place, brand new equipment, you know, but yet it's the same old people. That's the nice part about it. And you still got the relationships and everything that we have here. And they'll keep on going there, so it'll be good.
Well, we really appreciate the time you've shared with us. It's been a wonderful interview.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Randy.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you.